Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Sometimes one little comma makes all the difference. A good example is this lyric from Jay-Z. In his verse on Kanye West's song Diamonds from Sierra Leone, Jay-Z says, "I'm not a businessman, I'm a business man." Now, Jay-Z's story of raising himself up by his own bootstraps is a tale driven by music and by his own marketing savvy. But what happens to all those musicians who are also really talented, but don't have the drive or the desire to do all the business end stuff? Because let's face it, it's one thing to make a record on your laptop in your bedroom. It's another to get it out to the world and try and make a living from it. Well, we'll speak with one gifted songwriter who says she didn't get into this business to be a businesswoman. We'll also get to meet Salaam Remy. Now, we've mentioned him on Soundcheck before. He's the guy who produced Amy Winehouse and Nas and a host of others. Now he's got his own record and his own record label. And we'll hear live music from jazz sax player Matana Roberts and her band. Music based on the history of free people of color in the early United States. She has an amazing story, so stay with us for that. The singer-songwriter Alina Simone recently published an op-ed in the New York Times under the title "The End of Quiet Music," and it raises some very interesting questions about what it's like to be an independent musician in 2013. Hi, Alina.
Hi, John.
So this whole article is about you and other musicians being kind of forced into being entrepreneurs as well as artists. Is that right?
I'd say so, yeah. My article is sort of about opting out, you know, and making the choice to essentially not make more music or not to record another album. I've had three labels release my music previously. They are now all out of business. So there was this infrastructure when I first started out, you know, about 10 years ago. And it's sort of an entry-level infrastructure of little labels that support emerging artists, and it doesn't really exist anymore. And what's replaced it, for the most part, is Kickstarter.
So let me just back up to something you said a moment ago, which is, and you say this in the article as well, you've opted out. You're not making music anymore. Is it that stark a choice? It's like you either make music and you're the entrepreneur promoting it, or you don't make music. Isn't there a middle ground where you could still be making music and opt out of the business part?
Of course. I mean, I make music at home, and I can, you know, I released on Bandcamp a collection of my raw demos that was just, you know, stuff that I'd recorded over the years that I hadn't put out on any labels. And that, you know, that sold to some folks, and that was nice. So, I mean, I feel like I could make bedroom recordings, and
right.
I could do the sort of thing that doesn't involve the kind of investment that a, you know, full-length, professionally produced album that is marketed to the, you know, marketed nationally or even internationally. That's really what I'm opting out of, not like music or loving music or making
right.
music. Yeah.
Okay, so now with your last album, Make Your Own Danger, did you end up having to do a lot of this stuff yourself?
Yeah, I did. I did a lot myself. I mean, I feel like in the article, since it's a short article, I didn't have room to give a shout out to the folks who helped me, because I do have a great distributor, which is a virtual label. They're in Brooklyn, and they've got a really interesting model and were incredibly helpful. I did hire a publicist, so I had, you know, help. But still, even with that, I just felt like I was spending so much of my time on business. I was packing every CD and every demo myself. I was going to the post office with garbage bags full of CD mailers. I was dealing with spreadsheets and with manufacturers. And I was like, I don't like this. I don't want to do this.
Yeah. Although some people listening might hear you talking about, you know, the big satchel of CDs over your shoulder taking to the post office and think, that's a good problem to have. You could have been going to the post office with one CD and a mailer.
Not every day, John, you know, but in the beginning.
I understand what you're saying. Alina Simone is here. This is the album that she had to work so hard to make and then to promote, the album called Make Your Own Danger. Well, I'd buy that. But Alina Simone doesn't want to sell it to me.
Wait, that's not true.
I know. The album's Make Your Own Danger. The song is Beautiful Machine. So your op-ed piece in the Times, which was headlined The End of Quiet Music, basically you got into this business to be a musician, not to be a business person. Is that, if I had to put it in a nutshell, is that it?
Right, and then the situation changed. I mean, the landscape changed around me, and it was no longer no longer had the same opportunities that I had when I started out.
And just the title, The End of Quiet Music, just to let folks know, usually the newspaper or the magazine comes up with the title, right?
True. I would have called it The Right to Be Quiet, because I feel like that's an important right for musicians to have, the right to their privacy, you know, the right to keep, you know, requests for money even private, the mm-hmm. right to opt out of, you know, selling things all the time.
Alina Simone is obviously with us here in the Soundcheck studio. Soundcheck listeners, what do you think? Are we asking too much of musicians to both make the music, create the art, and to market and promote it as well? You can leave a comment on our website, soundcheck.org. And joining me as well is Jason King, associate professor at the Clive Davis Institute of Recorded Music at NYU. And Jason, your job is to help prepare young people for a career in music, both the artistic and the business end. What's your response to Alina's article?
Yeah, well, John, that is our role at the Clive Davis Institute of Recorded Music. What we're there to do is to bring in students, undergraduate students, who see themselves as artists, but who are also committed to the business of creating and selling recorded music. And so they have to really be comfortable with that marriage of art and business. They take classes in producing, classes in performing, but they also have to learn how to read contracts if they're a performer. They have to know how to empower themselves from a business perspective. And every student who goes through our program actually has to create a full plan for a business that they have to launch, whether it's their own record label or marketing company, that kind of thing. So the students that we have at NYU are already committed to that. They're kind of artists slash entrepreneurs. And I think that's part of what's happened in the music industry of the last 10 to 15 years, that as recorded music has become devalued as a commodity to some degree, more and more artists who already have an entrepreneurial spirit are the ones who are rising to the top. So the Pharrell Williams of the world and those kinds of artists who are doing that. I think that what we're basically talking about here is DIY, right? The do-it-yourself spirit, which is as old as recorded music itself. There's always been DIY artists who've had to not just make the music, but also self-promote and push their work. And I think to some degree, that's still what's happening. And I think you can actually help people become better at the DIY process.
Well, you guys are doing that at NYU. You know, at the Juilliard, they're now doing that as well. You know, the classical music kids are also being taught sort of basic business skills to get out there and like survive in what is a very cutthroat business. So, I mean, Alina, the idea of DIY is sort of a received tradition. You know, it's a classic way of making art of any form.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I think that all musicians have that spirit to an extent. I mean, you can't start out without recording something, right, without playing shows, without getting people to your shows. There's so much that you have to do and that musicians do constantly to promote themselves and always have. I think one thing that I worry about is, like, you know, if you think back 10, 20, 30 years, I mean, we had Nirvana, you know, we had artists like Sean Marshall, we had kids who didn't go to college, who played in clubs, who were discovered, who worked very hard, but were not necessarily from the kinds of backgrounds where they had, you know, laptops and, mm-hmm. you know, marketing mm-hmm. savvy, and frankly, the kind of family and friends that could contribute to a Kickstarter. And I think that, you know, we as a society are poorer for not kind of having that entry-level infrastructure there, something for those artists, too, that might not have access to the Kickstarter on, you know, all that stuff.
Well, now, you've mentioned Kickstarter a couple of times. This is the fan funding website. Is that not an entry-level? I mean, Jason, do you guys sort of teach that part of the business to the students?
We don't teach a course on Kickstarter at this point, but we definitely identify that as one way in which young people can make money. It's just basically a way to self-finance. Mm-hmm. I think it's we're in a transitional moment where it's a kind of crude way sometimes to self-finance, because it means you're having a direct appeal on the internet to your fans and saying, please support my album, give me $500 and I'll take you out to lunch or something like that. It's not always the most subtle or effective way of self-financing.
But sometimes it can be super effective.
Absolutely.
And Alina, in your article, The End of Quiet Music, you refer to your friend Amanda Palmer, who had a very successful Kickstarter campaign, as she described to us when she joined us here in the Soundcheck studio last September.
I started a Kickstarter that lasted the whole month of May, and the Kickstarter goal was $100,000 and ended up making more than $1 million.
Right.
But we had already recorded the record. So basically, I went into debt. I borrowed a bunch of money from various people and spent all of my own, and then just hoped and prayed that I would make it back on the Kickstarter, which I did. I'm really not the killing type.
Obviously, Alina, not everybody who goes on Kickstarter makes a gazillion dollars or five times what they ask for. But what for you? What is the what's the turnoff with the whole Kickstarter? Why are you not going that route?
I feel like I'm coming off as anti-Kickstarter. I've probably supported five Kickstarters this year.
Yeah.
Totally not anti-Kickstarter. I mean, and for me, it's not even Kickstarter specifically. It's just sort of looking forward and thinking, you know, I'd like to develop as an artist. I'd like to do more than I did the last time. I'd like to make a better album than I did the last time. That requires, you know, more resources and just sort of more support than I think I can muster myself around myself. I think that in my article, I pointed out this really extraordinary thing happened to me. This editor heard my music on Pandora. This was about 4 years ago. Literally went to the now non-existent Virgin Megastore, bought all my albums, and offered me a book deal just because he thought there was something in my music and my lyrics that might translate into prose. And literally for the first time in my life, I was the beneficiary of artistic development. I mean, I had a book sort of commissioned by a guy who thought I had potential. And I was like, wow, this is what it must have been like in like the early days.
The heyday of the music industry.
Yeah. Where someone savvy just hears someone, sees them working hard out in, you know, the live music environment, and is like, I'm going to take a chance on you. I'm going to make a reckless bet, you know, or a
but
savvy
that,
bet.
That still
you know?
Happens. It just it's happens true. Less than it happened in the past.
Absolutely.
And, you know, on one hand, you have the superstar artists, the small cadre of superstar artists that are being promoted and marketed by major labels. On the other hand, you have everybody else who's trying to make a living on a daily basis doing it. And I think one of the things that's great about your piece is that you identify the kind of loss of a sort of middle-class music maker, distributor, the independent labels and so on. It's harder and harder for those kinds of labels and entities to stay afloat in the music industry.
Well, it also seems that, Jason, one of the other points Alina's making, you're sitting right here, but I'm going to put words in your mouth anyway, is that, you know, for those people who by, you know, by choice or by virtue of how they are personally constructed, find it kind of odd or distasteful or, you know, don't want to be involved in asking for money, you know, via Kickstarter or something.
Yeah. I think it's a kind of digital busking, right? I mean, you're out there directly almost asking people for money. Sometimes even it feels like a kind of panhandling for some. But it can be very successful. It's just that it's Kickstarter and other online fan funding sites, they're one means of raising money. There's so many other ways of raising money. And you also don't have to just do it alone. I mean, entrepreneurship is not just a solo venture. It's something that you can, you know, who's your team? Who's working with you?
Is there someone out there that, you know, you could, that maybe you point out to the kids in the school or could point out to us who is doing it right? Someone who's, you know, doing it themselves, independent, you know, kind of label-free, and yet somehow doing it well.
Well, I think there's a lot of artists who are trying to find their way without a label. Very often artists realize that they can do certain things on their own without a label, but if they want to blow up and have the kinds of careers that they might admire, you know, when they're watching television and listening to the radio and so on, they have to take certain steps to achieve those. So we can look at somebody like an Ingrid Michaelson, who, you know, found ways to promote and market her music outside of the traditional label structure, all the way to somebody like Macklemore today, you know, who, you know, also found some interesting ways around the traditional music industry. But at the end of the day, a lot of artists feel that, you know, major labels aren't their enemy necessarily. They're just one way to gain some financing and to get promoted in a way that they probably couldn't do on their own.
They had a broken keyboard, I bought a broken keyboard. I bought a ski blanket, then I bought a kneeboard. Hello, hello, my ace man, my mellow. John Wayne ain't got nothing on my fringe game, hello. I could take some pro wings, make them cool, sell those. The sneakerheads would be like, ah, he got the Velcro.
I'm gonna pop some tags, only got $20 in my pocket.
We're speaking with Jason King, associate professor at the Clive Davis Institute of Recorded Music in New York at NYU, and Alina Simone, the singer and songwriter and now author of two books. There's the memoir, You Must Go and Win, and then there's the new novel called Note to Self. So you, Alina, as you mentioned before, the beneficiary of essentially artist development, A&R, in the publishing industry.
Yeah.
And so is it your hope that the music industry can get back to that somehow? That they're, I mean, the age of the big record labels being able to swoop down and pluck you out of obscurity and make you a star, as Jason pointed out, they're not entirely gone, but it's largely gone. And there's a lot of people who don't want to go back to that.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I make this point in my article, too. But I think from this strange new vantage point I had, suddenly a writer, there were all these opportunities that were available to me that had never been available to me as a singer. You know, grants, residencies, teaching opportunities. There are all these things you could kind of apply for, and mentorship opportunities, just time to think, time to work and make something.
Well, and as you mentioned in the article, you know, the thinking has often been in the philanthropic community, if it's pop music, let the market decide.
Yeah.
But the market has changed utterly in the digital age.
Right. So the question is, why don't these other institutions change as well? I mean, musicians have changed a lot. I mean, people, it's constant, you know, the new technological thingies that we can do to raise money and tell people and run campaigns to incentivize fans and do this and that. But what about the institutions that support culture and the arts? What about, you know, the Guggenheim Foundation? What about the NEA? What about places like NYU that hire people to teach things like creative writing and poetry? Why isn't the craft of songwriting taught alongside those genres?
But we do. We teach all
those
things.
Okay, you do? Yeah, you absolutely teach songwriting? I'm sorry.
Yeah. And actually,
I think that's great.
But a lot of universities are doing pop music instruction, right, in certain kinds of ways, and whether it's on the business side or whether it's performance or production and so on. I think that's happening at the university level. There are also, musicians have also been the recipients of all kinds of State Department grants and so on to travel abroad. I think the problem is, you know, would the NEH or the NEA give Beyonce money, you know, for what she's doing? No, because she's a, you know, self-propelling commodity who's already making a lot of money. So
right.
I think what we're talking about is at the sort of DIY independent level, can those kinds of artists who are aiming for pop music success get funded by state institutions?
Well, I mean, I think that to my mind, there's no difference between like a Jonathan Franzen and an Elliott Smith. I mean, I don't like
one's alive and one's not.
Yes, that is a big difference. But I mean, in terms of their talent or their contribution to, you know, art, and I mean, so to my mind, I don't really understand why a commercially successful writer or painter or whatever can get these grants and someone as successful, you know, at the commercial level in the field of music can't. I'm not talking about necessarily Beyonce, but somebody who's more like a middle class or, even upper middle class musician.
Well, are you familiar with the Canadian system? Because we've been sort of impressed, Jason, with Canadian artists coming here with records. You know, they're well-known artists, maybe not Arcade Fire, but the next level down, you know, bands like Stars or whatever. And they come in here and on the back of their record is, you know, funded in part by the Canadian Music Center or the Canadian Music Council. There is government support for making pop music records in Canada. We don't have anything like that, do we?
Not exactly like, I'm Canadian, so I can certainly speak
on
that. We don't have anything exactly like what Canada has, but I don't think we should also romanticize that process either. It's difficult, right, sometimes to get grants. It's difficult for some Canadian artists to break big internationally. There's content laws that, you know, dictate, you know, a lot of what Canadian musicians can and can't do. So, you know, I think, and there's also other countries like Norway and so on that also, you know, do a lot of funding for artists that we could look to as examples. But, you know, I don't think we should romanticize any of those because musicians have difficulty mm-hmm. getting their work, you know, produced and promoted anywhere.
Well, it is, as we've talked about already, a rapidly changing landscape and lots of people still finding their way through it. Lena Simone's article for the New York Times is called The End of Quiet Music, and her latest book is a novel called Note to Self. You'll find a link to her New York Times op-ed piece on our website at soundcheck.org. Jason King is associate professor at the Clive Davis Institute of Recorded Music at NYU. And to both of you, Alina, Jason, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Career opportunity, the one that never knocked. Every job I offer used to keep you up the dock. Career opportunity, the one that never knocked.
All right, this conversation is obviously just getting started. Musicians, we want to hear your reactions. How successfully have you been able to juggle the music side and the business side of your career? Do digital tools and social media make it easier or harder to get your music out there? Leave a comment at soundcheck.org or a voicemail at 866-939-1612. That's 866-939-1612, and we might feature your remarks on an upcoming episode of Soundcheck. Up next, the producer Salaam Remy has carved out quite a career for himself after working with the late Amy Winehouse, among others. He'll tell us about working on the other side of the control room glass for his own record next.
Nobody stand in between me and my man.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. At the top of producer Salaam Remy's resume is his work with this artist, Amy Winehouse. He co-produced the Grammy-winning singer's hit album Back to Black along with Mark Ronson. And Salaam was working on her third album at the time of her death in 2011. He's also worked with artists like the rapper Nas, the breakout R&B singer Miguel, and the Fugees. But now, Salaam Remy is stepping out of the control room and into the spotlight. His debut solo album is called One, In the Chamber, and he's here with me in the Soundcheck studio. Salaam, welcome.
Thanks for having me. Glad I could be here.
So you've had this enormously successful career behind the scenes. Why step out there now?
I think for me it's the process of also just having music for music's sakes. And, you know, I always loved the fact that my greatest success as a producer has also been an artistic success as well at the same time. So all of the Amy Winehouse at the moment when it happened or the Fugees at the moment when it happened was also as left as it was, you know, something that was successful. So with my project and in general, you know, what I'm doing with my new label, Flying Buddha, through my Sony imprints is mm-hmm. basically saying, like, look, if you want to hear music for music's sake, will come over here. And with this whole project, it's a lot of the artists that I've worked with and their pop sensibilities, but them coming out and working with me in my orchestral musical space and saying, this is a body of work for the movie that I'm creating for my album right now. So, you know, it's a bit different for all of them, mm-hmm. but at the same time, it's just where I live.
It has a very kind of cinematic sound to it, you know, the full orchestra and everything. That's you conducting the orchestra, right?
I actually didn't conduct it, but I, you know, did the arrangements and put the pieces together. And it's a spinoff of my film scoring work because mm-hmm. I scored Sparkle mm-hmm. last year. So that's where the Jordan Sparks track came from when she starred in Sparkle and I scored it. Or different pieces of it. But over the last 7 or 8 years, I've been doing a lot with orchestras in Prague, just experimenting and coming up with different pieces. So my experimentation of Eleanor Rigby turned into the Stephen Marley version. version. Or even when I had a song and I'd be like, you know what, let's book a session every couple months and just try getting some different sounds and, you know, taking the arrangements to another level, which is a passion of mine. So mm-hmm. this is my passion project in a way where I'm able to now let people hear and feel how far the music can go.
Now, most of the songs are original to this recording, but you mentioned Eleanor Rigby, the Beatles right. classic. You got Stephen Marley, one of Bob Marley's sons, to, right. to do the vocals here. How do you make those decisions to pair a particular singer with a particular song?
Actually, I mean, with Eleanor Rigby, it was just, once again, I was experimenting with the rooms and seeing, okay, what size room, what size arrangement I'm going to get to actually do that. A lot of it is just musical conversations and finding people who love music the same way that I do. So then that way, we're now just given the expression at that moment. So, no, that particular piece of it came out of just an idea and then the execution.
Let's hear a little bit of Salaam Remy's arrangement of the Beatles' Eleanor Rigby, featuring vocals by Stephen Marley.
Father McKenzie, writing the words of a sermon that no one will hear. No one comes near. Look at him working, darning his socks in the night when there's nobody there. What does he care? All the lonely people, where do they all come from? All the lonely people, where do they all belong? Died in the church and was buried along with her name. Nobody came. Father McKenzie, wiping the dirt from his hands as he walks from the grave. No one was saved. All them lonely.
Salaam Remy's version of Eleanor Rigby, featuring Stephen Marley singing. Salaam, the Grammy-nominated producer for artists like Nas and Amy Winehouse, Alicia Keys, the Fugees. His solo album's called One in the Chamber. It's out now. You don't sing on this record. There's lots of singers and lots of songs, but your job is what? To kind
keeping
of
keeping it together. I mean, arranging it, and you know, ultimately, a lot of it is my vision as far as musically where we go. And something that I feel like I've owned as far as what my taste is. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of times we'll create something and I'll just be like, I like it, but it's a little bit outside of my palate. Because ultimately, you know, your album is your plate of food. So this is basically that. And that's why, you know, there's 9 vocals, 3 instrumentals, but it's all still what I would feel and what I would represent as me.
And so it's people that you've worked with like Corinne Bailey Rae and right. Jordan Sparks and Akon. Now, Akon, he does the title track.
Correct.
What does that title mean? One, it's one colon in the chamber.
Right. So, I mean, Akon's song is just one in the chamber straight mm-hmm. across, which, you know, you have to kind of listen to it and get into it. But basically, this is a story about him going and seeing a girl who he hadn't seen for a while. And he should have gotten away, but he went back and now she has one in the chamber. Now she's pregnant, basically. So she has
okay.
one in the chamber. So it's a double entendre.
Yeah.
But also it was a dangerous move that he made that now he's going to have to pay for.
I also wondered if it maybe was also a pun on all the strings, you know, the idea of chamber music.
Well, the album is definitely one in the chamber with the strings in that. So, no, the album is one as my first album,
mm-hmm.
semicolon, in the chamber, which definitely is a pun on the strings as well.
All right, here's a little bit of the title track from Salaam Remy, featuring vocals by Akon.
We'll never be the same now. Just when I thought I was out of danger, phone rang and I still went out and banged her. Yeah, banged her.
That is the title track from Salaam Remy's new album called One in the Chamber, the title track sung by Akon. Now, let me ask you something. That's the clean version. Mm-hmm. The original album version, when he says messed up in the radio version, he's saying something else on the record. So do you record two different tracks, you know, when you're producing the album specifically with radio play in mind?
With this song, I mean, we felt like once we did it with the regular version that is not as clean, then I just had him go and clean up those words on another track so I can do a quick edit and put it together. So there would be, rather than it just being bleeped out, mm-hmm. you know, which can be disgusting at times. I was just like, you know what, just say that word instead. And he made sure he had a version that worked the other way as well.
Right.
We didn't do the whole song over. We just did the
You just
words.
Had him do
the words.
The offensive parts.
Exactly. Those words.
And all of the production on the voice, the auto-tuning and everything, that's you or him? I mean, how's that?
We're in the studio together. I mean, it's all the pieces and different stuff, and even parts of it that seem like it's actually tuned, that's actually his voice going up. It's funny that Akon has Senegalese real timbre on his voice, so even if you think that he's actually been old, sometimes he's not. So that's his falsetto, which he's never actually used on a record before.
Wow.
But he's actually singing higher, so that's not like him being pitched up like a chipmunk. He actually can sing like that.
We're speaking with Salaam Remy, the Grammy-nominated producer. Where did this all begin for you?
I mean, first of all my uncles are musicians. So my mother's two brothers, you know, one of them played saxophone around James Brown, the other one played keyboards at Sugar Hill Records and The Moments and whatever it was. And then my dad's brothers, one played with Lionel Liston Smith, and then my dad himself worked with Belafonte. He did Jazzmobile, he did, you know, disco records, Tina Gardner, he produced hip hop. He kind of went through all the different phases. So I would say a lot of the music was around me. Elvin Jones, the jazz drummer, made a drum set for me when I was 3 because he saw me in the store messing around with stuff.
Now, wait a minute. Elvin Jones. John Coltrane's Elvin Jones.
Correct.
Made you your first drum kit.
I was in the music store with my dad. It was a music store that's around like 46th, just off of...
off 6th Avenue.
Off 7th Avenue. It's a drum store on the second floor.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was in there as a small kid. I really remember being there. And he seemed to have been watching me walk around the store and seeing that I had a real sense of rhythm. And I must have been playing paradiddles at 3 or something like that, doing some complicated pattern. And he pretty much took, and I still have it in my grandmother's basement, a large floor tom, almost like a cocktail drum set, and took the large floor tom and made it into a kick drum and then put a snare and put it all together. My dad bought what he put together. Like, you know what, this is a drum set for him. And so I had a real drum set when I was 3.
Wow. So were you a drummer first?
Initially, I guess that was my first instrument in that way. But, you know, ultimately I could hear it all. So I just, you know, over the years continued to play keyboards a bit, play bass a bit, play whatever it is. And even now I can pretty much play a rhythm section myself on a lot of the songs. I'm playing the majority of the instruments, and I might have someone else add a guitar or a horn or whatever else it is.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of records, you know, even the Carmen Bailey Ray song, whatever, it's pretty much me playing.
One of the things that really kind of showcases your command of orchestration, of arranging, is the fact that you've got instrumental tracks.
Oh,
you know,
definitely.
I mean, pop music used to be full of instrumentals, you
right.
know, and that it sort of disappeared for a while.
Right. I mean, I love that aspect of it. I mean, it's the same thing. I was working on stuff and looking at the orchestral aspect of it and felt that between, you know, the instrumentals, between, you know, I did a version of Keep Rising to the Top by Kenny Burke, which is a Queen's anthem party favorite from the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I remember the time growing up in New York in the Ed Koch era when it was I Love New York, when the Chuck Mangione Feel So Good was the theme of New York.
Right.
And everywhere you turned around, that horn wouldn't stop. So I felt like, you know, as being a native New Yorker and feeling like those types of pieces were really important to me, as well as having vocal pieces, I could have made this all instrumental. I did an album before called Prognosis that was all instrumental orchestras.
And that was all recorded in Prague in the Czech Republic.
Exactly.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It became the Prognosis.
Right.
And then those instrumentals.
I get it.
Exactly. All those instrumentals became some of Nas's Life is Good album. It became Jasmine Sullivan's Bust Your Windows and Lions, Tigers, and Bears. So I was incorporating all of my orchestral pieces into my songs.
You know, so Bach did that. He would write pieces and then he would reuse them, and, you know.
In other spaces and find ways to do it. And for me, it's just an expressions of creativity. And, you know, making art for the love of music.
Well, let's hear one of the instrumental tracks from Salaam Remy from the album One in the Chamber. This is called, what are we saying here? Da 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 da?
Da 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 da.
Mm-hmm.
is music from my guest, Salaam Remy. All right, I'll give it a shot. Da, 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 da.
There it is. You got it.
The album's called One in the Chamber, one of the instrumental tracks. So is this likely to appear, you know, down the road as the backing track for someone else's song?
It's slightly possible. Who knows? But at this point, I'm enjoying it for what it is.
Yeah. Salaam Remy, of course, best known as a producer for people like Nas and Amy Winehouse and Alicia Keys. And you mentioned your own imprint on Sony Records earlier. Right. And you've begun producing another young singer, an actor, right?
Yes, I also have, for my Remy Fa label, I have a couple different, this is on Flying Buddha. My Remy Fa label is Mac Wilds, also actor known as Tristan Wilds, who we have a debut album out called New York, A Love Story, mm-hmm. us being native New Yorkers and getting our musical things together at this moment.
He was in The Wire.
He was on The Wire as Michael Lee on seasons 4 and 5, and he also was on 90210 as Dixon Wilson. For the last 4 or 5 years, Secret Life of Bees, Red Tails. He's a promising young upstart, but definitely there.
So what do you look for in, I mean, there's lots of promising young artists. What attracted you to Mac Wilds?
Number one, he's a great person. You know, that's, for me, it's like good people, good music. Good money will come, but good people, good music is my key. That's the start. And I looked at what he was able to do and just watched him develop. I actually didn't do any music with him until this year. But I just sat down and watched what he was doing on his own, gave him a couple pointers, and let him develop himself in a lot of ways. And when I really saw that, I saw a window for what he was able to do and what I could actually bring to the table and support it. You know, I said, you know what, let's try something. And, you know, our try has turned into a great album called New York, A Love Story, which I'm really proud of.
Salaam Remy, my guest on Soundcheck today. Salaam, great fun having you with us.
Oh, thank you.
Nothing's too much. Words that I live by. That's just how I do. Do, I do. I'm young right now, but I won't be forever. So I'ma live it up like that's true. You might want to roll with me too. Said I don't mean to pray, but I live a life that most can only dream.
Up next, saxophonist and composer Matana Roberts is spinning more stories as part of her project called Coin Coin. We'll hear all about it, and she and her band will play live in the studio. Next on Soundcheck.
Tell me where you wanna go, what you wanna do. Say we live in it like...
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Matana Roberts is a sax player, a singer, a band leader, but most of all, Matana Roberts is a storyteller. Maybe not in the way you'd think, but her so-called Coin Coin project is a series of images and impressions and improvisations on the history of free people of color in the United States. It's also the story of Matana's own family, as we'll hear. She and her band are going to start things off with us with an invocation. Here's Matana Roberts and the group live on Soundcheck.
Thank you.
That is called Invocation, and it comes to us from sax player and composer and bandleader Matana Roberts, playing alto sax live here in the Soundcheck studio, with Toma Fujiwara behind our drum kit, Shoko Nagai playing our piano, and Jeremiah Abia, the operatic voice. So we have the tenor voice, the alto sax, and Matana Roberts joining me at the microphone here in our Soundcheck studio. This is from the Coin Coin Project, Chapter 2. First of all, Matana, it's great to have you back with us on Soundcheck.
Thank you for having me. It's nice to be here.
What is the inspiration for Coin Coin, the Coin Coin Project?
My love of American history.
Mm-hmm.
I love American history, and I kind of grew up in an environment that was very much about remembering history and understanding history as a way to understand present times and the things that you might deal with in present times. And to also be reminded to be thankful for what it is that I do have, which is so much. My mm-hmm. life is so rich.
Now, Chapter 1, which came out a couple of, like, 2 years ago, right?
Yes.
Is called Gens de Couleur Libre.
Very nice, yes.
Free men of color, literally.
Yes.
The first time I ever heard that expression was many years ago, the Cajun musician Michael Doucet, mm-hmm. in sort of explaining how Cajun culture came together, said a very important part of it was free men of color.
Mm-hmm.
Who were the free men of color, and when are we talking about in American history?
Well, there are many different time periods within that of usage of that term. But for me and my family history, I'm dealing from about 1750 to 1830.
So that early?
For my people, yes.
Wow.
I do have some Cajun blood in me, mm-hmm. thanks to New Orleans, but a good portion of my people were from an area outside of Louisiana called Natchitoches. This woman, Marie-Thérèse Metoyer, was responsible for setting up this community that consisted of many free people of color. And many of the resources and experiences that I've been able to have today have a lot to do with those people and what they were able to accomplish at that time and the mores and values they passed down in my own family.
So you're able to trace your family back in this country as far back as 1750?
As 1750, yes. I cannot believe I can say that, but yes, I can say that. It's astonishing.
And so who were these people? What did they do? Where did they live? What's their story?
Most of them were land workers, business workers, people who came up through slavery, some being slaves themselves and were able to either buy themselves out of freedom or be bought out of freedom, and were able to establish businesses. Now, it's very particular that it was Louisiana that they were able to do this, because some of the most bizarre racial laws were going on in Louisiana. So it's such an interesting history where people were able to get away with things in that particular state that they could not get away with elsewhere. But it also has a lot to do with the skin color. My mother,
right.
for instance, was your complexion.
Really?
So, yes. So
I'm a pretty pale guy.
Yes. My uncle is blonde hair and blue eyed. Uh-huh. Used to get beat up all the time in the neighborhood for looking like the little white kid. Yes.
So the idea that these folks have been around for so long and have had such a kind of a rich history,
mm-hmm.
that gives you a great resource,
I guess,
it gives
me
draw
so
on.
Much to draw on. But I come from a family that also made it a point to keep records of things. A lot of things got passed to me from my great-great-grandmothers. Mm. A lot of the documentation I have came from my great-great-grandmothers. And my family has always been really interested in genealogy, so I have that too, combined with my interest in history. It's just
mm-hmm. We're speaking with Matana Roberts. Her latest album is The Coin Coin Project, Chapter 2. First of all, Coin Coin, where does that come from?
So that is the nickname that this woman, Marie Metoyer, would use, was given to her supposedly by her parents. And it was the nickname that she had throughout her lifetime. I'm told that she signed that name many different ways throughout her lifetime, and that it may not have been, in fact, been pronounced Coin Coin. But my grandfather and his brother were within, were raised by people that were blood related to that woman. And so coin is how it was passed down. Mm-hmm. And my grandfather used to use that as a nickname for me as a child.
Okay.
So
coin chapter 2, the new album is called, subtitled, Mississippi Moonchild.
Yes.
So at some point, was your family part of the Great Migration up the Mississippi?
Yes. So I'm trying to chart my heritage out of Mississippi, Tennessee, and Louisiana. And so I do have a Mississippi side. That's mostly my paternal side. That definitely were part of the Great Migration. It's why I was born in Chicago, mm-hmm. you know.
And in this piece, first of all, the album's like, there are 18 tracks, but it's one long through-composed
yes.
work. But there is a definite narrative arc.
Definitely, definitely.
And the use of texts mm-hmm. and voices. Mm-hmm. There are several spirituals that are used.
Yes, in this piece in particular.
So you've got the spirituals, the blues connection, and as I say, these voices, you speak, mm-hmm. you sing, mm-hmm. and of course Jeremiah is singing in the more operatic tradition. What do all those different voices signify?
Just community and the gathering of people. I'm so interested in the way people used to sing just to sing, where it was just something that was part of a work ethic, something that was part of a day-to-day. Singing is so uplifting.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's hear another song. This one's called Amma Jerusalem School. It once again comes from the coin Project, Chapter 2, Mississippi Moonchild. It is the latest from Matana Roberts. She and her band are performing two sets on Saturday night here in New York at the Jazz Gallery, but they're playing for us here in the Soundcheck studio today.
Center of return. There are some things I just can't tell you about, honey. I step on the stage one night, my heart went pity to pat. I heard somebody say, "Oh, little pretty girl, is that?" Joshua won the battle on Jericho, Jericho, Jericho. The daffodil steady and the lilies tall and fair. All the children love me, so why should I care? 4 months of school, 50 cents a day for chopping cotton. Sun up to sun down, honey, times was hard. Honey, times was hard. January 1949, I graduated when I was 23. Ho, dig grass, May 1949. There are some things I just can't tell you about, honey. We grew our own vegetables and daddy quilted too, though mama always said his stitches were too low. I sing because I'm happy, I sing because I'm free. His eyes on the sparrow and I know he watches over me.
Thank you.
That, once again, is Matana Roberts and her quartet performing live in the Soundcheck studio. The song is called Amma Jerusalem School. Brief quote of His Eye is on the Sparrow in
yes,
the middle
of
that.
My favorite.
Part of her Coin Coin project, Chapter 2, the album subtitled Mississippi Moonchild. It is out now, and Matana and the quartet performing at the Jazz Gallery on Saturday night at 9 and 10:30. Matana Roberts and her band playing for us here on Soundcheck today. Thank you very much. Great to see you again.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
Coming up on Monday, since forming in the early 80s, the Meat Puppets have been a hardcore band on SST, the famous punk label, a backup band for Nirvana's famous Unplugged concert, an alt-rock sensation, and a scary story of surviving in the music business. Before they play Soundcheck's showcase at this year's CBGB Festival, I'll talk with Kurt and Chris Kirkwood of the Meat Puppets. Also, the European duo known as Boy is actually made of two women. They'll bring their folk pop stylings to our studio for a live performance. Soundcheck is a production of WNYC. Irene Trudell leads our engineering team, which includes, at any given moment, Paul Schneider, Bill O'Neill, Jason Isaac, or Rick Kwan. The show is produced by Katie Bishop, Greta Cohn, and Mike Katziff, with Amy Pearl and our intern Alex Martinez. Our executive producer is Joel Meyer, and that's going to do it for the show today. Join us again on Monday. Have a great weekend. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.